Hi, Gonwald Audio. This is Higher Desire and Fire. I decided to do some hysterical literature, and the book that I am going to read for you is called Memoirs of Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by Charles Mackay. And this is a book from the 1800s on bubble economy. It's definitely not interesting to everybody, but it starts with the Mississippi scheme, goes on to the South Sea bubble and the tulip mania and alchemists and etc., etc. And it's definitely not for everybody, but it's interesting if you are at all into anything like that. But anyway, I thought I would take a rather dry book and make it a little more interesting. So here we go with the preface. In reading the history of nations, we find that, like individuals, they have their whims and their peculiarities. Their seasons of excitement and restlessness when they care not what they do. We find that whole communities suddenly fix their minds upon one object and go mad in its pursuit, that millions of people become simultaneously impressed with one delusion and run after it till their attention is caught by some new folly more captivating than the first. We see one nation suddenly seized from its highest to its lowest members with a fierce desire of military glory. Another is suddenly becoming crazed upon a religious scruple, and neither of them recovering its senses until it has shed rivers of blood and sowed a harvest of groans and tears to be reaped by its posterity. At an early age in the annals of Europe, its population lost their wits about the sepulchre of Jesus and crowded in frenzied multitudes to the Holy Land. Another age went mad for fear of the devil and offered up hundreds of thousands of victims to the delusion of witchcraft. At another time, the many became crazed on the subject of the Philosopher's Stone, and committed follies till then unheard of in the pursuit. It was once thought a venial offense in many countries of Europe to destroy an enemy by slow poison. Persons who would have revolted at the idea of stabbing a man to the heart drugged his pottage without scruple. Ladies of gentle birth and manners caught the contagion of murder until poisoning under their auspices became quite fashionable. Some delusions, though notorious to all the world, have subsisted for ages, flourishing as widely among civilized and polished nations as among the early barbarians with whom they originated. That of dueling, for instance, and the belief in omens and the divination of the future, which seem to defy the progress of knowledge to eradicate them entirely from the popular mind. Money, again, has often been the cause of delusion of multitudes. Sober nations have all at once become desperate gamblers and risked almost their existence upon the turn of a piece of paper. To trace the history of the most prominent of these delusions is the object of the present pages. Men, it has been well said, think in herds. It will be seen that they go mad in herds, while they only recover their senses slowly and one by one. Some of the subjects introduced may be familiar to the reader, but the author hopes that sufficient novelty of detail will be found even in these to render them acceptable, while they could not be wholly omitted in justice to the subject of which it was proposed to treat. The memoirs of the South Sea Madness and the Mississippi Delusion are more complete and copious than are to be found elsewhere, and the same may be said of the history of the Witch Mania, which contains an account of its terrific progress in Germany, a part of the subject which has been left comparatively untouched by Sir Walter Scott in his Letters on Demonology and Witchcraft, the most important that have yet appeared on this fearful but most interesting subject. Popular delusions began so early, spread so widely, and have lasted so long, that instead of two or three volumes, 50 would scarcely suffice to detail their history. The present may be considered more of a miscellany of delusions than a history, a chapter only in the great and awful book of human folly which yet remains to be written, and which Porson once jestingly said he would write in 500 volumes. Interspersed are sketches of some lighter matters, amusing instances of the imitativeness and wrong-headedness of the people, rather than examples of folly and delusion. Religious matters have been purposely excluded as incompatible with the limits prescribed in the present work. A mere list of them alone would be sufficient to occupy a volume. Money mania, the Mississippi scheme. Some in clandestine companies combine, erect new stocks to trade beyond the line. With air and empty names beguile the town, and raise new credits first, then cry 'em down. Divide the empty nothing into shares, and set the crowd together by the ears, Defoe. The personal character and career of one man are so intimately connected with the great scheme of the years 1719 and 1720 that a history of the Mississippi Madness can have no fitter introduction than a sketch of the life of its great author, John Law. Historians are divided in opinion as to whether they should designate him a knave or a madman. Both epithets were unsparingly applied to him in his lifetime, and while the unhappy consequences of his projects were still deeply felt, posterity, however, has found reason to doubt the justice of the accusation and to convince that John Law was neither knave nor madman, but one more deceived than deceiving, more sinned against than sinning. He was thoroughly acquainted with the philosophy and true principles of credit. He understood the monetary question better than any man of his day, and if his system fell with a crash so tremendous, it was not so much his fault as that of the people amongst whom he had erected it. He did not calculate upon the avaricious frenzy of a whole nation. He did not see that confidence, like mistrust, could be increased almost ad infinitum, and that hope was as extravagant as fear. How was he to foretell that the French people, like the man in the fable, would kill, in their frantic eagerness, the fine goose he had brought to lay them so many golden eggs? His fate was like that which may be supposed to have overtaken the first adventurous boatman who rowed from Erie to Ontario, broad and smooth. Was the river on which he embarked, rapid and pleasant was his progress. And who was to stay him in his career? Alas for him, the cataract was nigh. He saw, when it was too late, that the tide which had wafted him so joyously along was a tide of destruction. And when he endeavored to retrace his way, he found that the current was too strong for his weak efforts to stem, and that he drew nearer every instant to the tremendous falls. Down he went, over the sharp rocks, and the waters with him. He was dashed to pieces with his bark, but the waters, maddened and turned to foam by the rough descent, only boiled and bubbled for a time, and then flowed on again, as smoothly as ever. Just so it was with Law and the French people. He was the boatman, and they were the waters. John Law was born in Edinburgh in the year 1671. His father was the younger son of an ancient family in Fife, and carried on the business of a goldsmith and banker. He amassed considerable wealth in his trade, sufficient to enable him to gratify the wish so common among his countrymen of adding a territorial designation to his name. He purchased with this view the estates of Lauriston and Randleston on the Firth of Forth on the borders of West and Midlothian, and was thenceforth known as Law of Lauriston. The subject of our memoir, being the eldest son, was received into his father's counting house at the age of 14, and for 3 years labored hard to acquire an insight into the principles of banking as then carried on in Scotland. He had always manifested great love for the study of numbers, and his proficiency in the mathematics was considered extraordinary in one of his tender years. At the age of 17, he was tall, strong, and well-made. And his face, although deeply scarred with the smallpox, was agreeable in its expression and full of intelligence. At this time he began to neglect his business, and becoming vain of his person, indulged in considerable extravagance of attire. He was a great favorite with the ladies, by whom he was called Beau Law, while the other sex, despising his foppery, nicknamed him Jessamy John. At the death of his father, which happened in 1688, he withdrew entirely from the desk, which had become so irksome, and being possessed of the revenues of the paternal estate of Lauriston, he proceeded to London to see the world. He was now very young, very vain, good-looking, tolerably rich, and quite uncontrolled. It is no wonder that on his arrival in the capital he should launch out into extravagance. He soon became a regular frequenter of the gaming houses, and by pursuing a certain plan based upon some abstruse calculations of chances, he contrived to gain considerable sums. All the gamblers envied him his luck, and many made it a point to watch his play and stake their money on the same chances. In affairs of gallantry, he was equally fortunate. Ladies of the first rank smiled graciously upon the handsome Scotchman, the young, the rich, the witty, and the obliging. But all these successes only paved the way for reverses. After he had been for 9 years exposed to the dangerous attractions of the gay life he was leading, he became an irrecoverable gambler. As his love of play increased in violence, it diminished in prudence. Great losses were only to be repaired by still greater ventures, and one unhappy day he lost more than he could repay without mortgaging his family estate. To that step he was driven at last. At the same time, his gallantry brought him into trouble. A love affair or slight flirtation with a lady of the name of Villiers exposed him to the resentment of a Mr. Wilson, by whom he was challenged to fight a duel. Law accepted and had the ill fortune to shoot his antagonist dead upon the spot. He was arrested the same day and brought to trial for murder by the relatives of Mr. Wilson. He was afterwards found guilty and sentenced to death. The sentence was commuted to a fine upon the ground that the offense only amounted to manslaughter, an appeal being lodged by a brother of the deceased. Law was detained in the King's Bench, whence by some means or other which he never explained, he contrived to escape. And an action being instituted against the sheriffs, he was advertised in the Gazette, and a reward offered for his apprehension. He was described as Captain John Law, a Scotchman aged 26, a very tall, black, lean man, well-shaped, above 6 feet high, with large pockholes in his face, big-nosed and speaking broad and loud. Oh, oh, God. Memoirs of Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds by Charles Mackay.